It's Wednesday, October 30, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As I mentioned yesterday, a federal judge in the state of Texas blocked a very important part of Texas's restrictive new abortion law. As the New York Times reports, this is a provision that would have required doctors performing the abortion procedure to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. You'll recall that during the summer, the Texas legislature went into a special session called there by Texas Governor Rick Perry in order to enact legislation that would restrict access to abortion in that state after a similar effort failed, caused by a very long filibuster undertaken by Texas State Senator Wendy Davis, who has since announced that she's running for governor. The Texas situation points to the fact that the abortion issue not only has not gone away, it continues to be a very deep divide in America. So deep, in fact, that those who are contending for the sanctity of every life, including unborn life, have pointed to Texas as a great success in terms of these new restrictions. On the other hand, those who are pressing for a woman's unfettered right to an abortion at every stage for any reason, they see what happened in Texas as exactly what must be stopped in its tracks. And thus you have this battle that has gone on first in the legislature and then now in the courts. And as the Texas governor has announced, the state of Texas is going to appeal this to the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals immediately. But there's something very interesting, not only in terms of the specifics of this case, but of the news coverage of what took place in this federal court decision. In this case, I want to credit Eric Eckholm of the New York Times for very comprehensive coverage. The lead in his article makes clear that the judge struck down one provision in the law. He left another provision intact with some modification, and other provisions of the law weren't even in consideration in this court case. Contrast that with the release that came from the Associated Press. The first paragraph of that release, run in many newspapers across the country, reads like this. A federal judge has determined that new Texas abortion restrictions violate the U.S. Constitution, a ruling that keeps open, at least for now, dozens of abortion clinics that were set to halt operations Tuesday, had the law taken effect, end quote. This would imply that the entire law was stricken, and yet that is hardly the case. One provision out of several was actually stricken by this court, and it's not stricken permanently, but rather in an action undertaken by a federal district court. This judge was sitting in Austin, Texas, later to be reviewed by appellate courts. I point to this disparity in the news coverage in order to remind us that when we see something reported in the news, we often have to press further to understand if this is an accurate report, or at least a comprehensive report, because sometimes telling part of the story is really to tell the story untruthfully. Going back to the case itself, the federal judge in Austin struck down a provision that called for abortionists to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. The judge says, in his words, that the Act's admitting privileges provision is without a rational basis and places a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus, end quote. What's really going on here is this. Here you have a judge making a decision that the provision in this law that required a doctor performing an abortion to have admitting privileges in a hospital is, as he said, without a rational basis. And let's ask a clear question. What would the rational basis for that provision be? It would be this, that anyone who is conducting a surgical operation as potentially dangerous and as undoubtedly surgical as an abortion is, should at least have the same kind of privileges and the same kind of thus rank and recognition that a surgeon performing any other kind of surgical operation would be expected to have. This judge has ruled that that provision has no rational basis. Really? This is likely to be an issue of contention as this case goes for appeal not only to the Circuit Appeals Court but eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court, where this challenge is almost certainly very soon to arrive. Depending on how you count these particular provisions, somewhere between 12 and 15 states have adopted legislation very close to what's taken place in Texas. Thus, what's going on in Texas is never just about what's going on in Texas. It's about what's going on in the rest of the country, or will soon, as well. Also remember this. When you look back to 1973 and that lamentable Roe v. Wade decision, remember that that, too, began in Texas. On a related issue, Eric Eckholm also provided a very interesting article that made the front page of the New York Times. The headline of that article is this, Case Explores Rights of Fetus versus Mother. As Eckholm explains, what's going on in Wisconsin is very different than what's going on in Texas, but it has a similar concern, a concern to protect unborn human life. Under the law known as the Cocaine Mom Act when it was adopted in 1998, child welfare authorities can forcibly confine a pregnant woman who uses illegal drugs or alcohol to a severe degree and who refuses to accept treatment. Now that's being challenged. Now let's go back to that law. What would the rational basis of that law be? The rational basis of that 1998 law in Wisconsin is that a mother who would not act in a way that would protect her unborn child, but would, to the contrary, undertake activities such as severe drug use that might threaten the child's health or even its life, that in that case the state had a responsibility to step in and protect the child, even from its own mother. Now you have a major challenge to that law. Lynn Paltrow, executive director of the National Advocates for Pregnant Women in New York, says this, quote, "This is what happens when laws give officials the authority to treat fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses as if they are already completely separate from the pregnant woman," end quote. Let's take a closer look at that sentence. Here you have a woman identified as the executive director of something known as the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, who clearly might advocate for women, but not for unborn human life. She very clearly, using the terms eggs, embryos, and fetuses, wants to act as if this human being in the womb at every stage right up to birth has no rights whatsoever until it has an existence separate from its mother. Let's point out the incongruities in the law. Very famously, it has now become a matter of common homicide prosecution that if a pregnant woman is killed along with her unborn child, there are two murder victims involved. Here you have a group saying that, well, that may be so, but let's put that out of mind. When it comes to a woman's responsibility for damage to her fetus, intentional damage after warning, this should not be a matter of concern because that fertilized egg, that embryo, or that fetus, to use her words, has no existence and thus no moral status until it is separate from its mother. Another interesting aspect of this story is the fact that it defies the traditional very clean lines between the pro-life and the pro-choice or pro-abortion position. What we're looking at here is the reality that there are some who would classify themselves undoubtedly as pro-choice who would also want this law, as was passed in Wisconsin and other states, to be held in effect because of their concern for babies being born with fetal alcohol syndrome or with very severe abnormalities caused by narcotics use or other forms of behavior on the part of their mothers. When you look at a case like this, one of the saddest things are the lines of argument that are being produced. For instance, those who are challenging this law in Wisconsin have produced medical authorities who have said, to quote from Eckholm's report, that the laws are based on exaggerated perceptions of the risk to newborns and are medically counterproductive. Now, what would they mean by that? By medically counterproductive, they mean this. If a mother is going to abuse her child and she knows that thus she might be placed under some kind of legal restriction, she might not show up for any kind of prenatal care at all. Well, that's the kind of argument that might make sense if you take the moral equation of the fetus out of the picture. Before we leave this issue, let's recognize this. This article proves one point very clearly. Even those who do not want to deal with the moral status of unborn human life eventually have to deal with it anyway. Even if they're challenging the law and making bad arguments, the arguments actually end up, years after this law is adopted, on the front page of the New York Times. Next, shifting to a new report released by a group known as Opportunity Nation, we find that many things are considered in terms of growing income inequality in America, but one thing is not, and that one thing is very important. It is the issue of marriage. W. Bradford Wilcox of the University of Virginia points out that Opportunity Nation, a group committed to working across partisan and ideological lines, in their own words, quote, to expand economic opportunity and close the opportunity gap in America, end quote, has released a major study known as Opportunity Index. The Opportunity Index includes 16 indicators. They include such things as high school graduation and income inequality. But as Wilcox says, his own research indicates that adolescents raised in intact married homes are significantly more likely to succeed educationally and financially. The benefits are greatest for the least privileged homes, that is, where their mother did not have a college degree. The essence of what Bradford Wilcox is pointing to here is the fact that when people talk about income inequality and they're trying to answer the question, why do some people move ahead in this society and others move behind, at least in economic terms, they want to look at virtually everything except the one thing that may matter the most, and that is, from what home did this individual come? What was the marital status of his or her parents? A couple of data points come from Wilcox's research. Number one, young adults are at least 44% more likely to have graduated from college if they were raised by their married parents. In other words, very significant data point here. The children who come from homes where parents are married and they were raised all the way to college age, they are 44% more likely to have graduated from college. When you're talking about income inequality and who moves ahead economically in this society, college graduation is at the center of that equation. But as Bradford Wilcox points out, marriage is at the center of that question. The second data point is this. Men and women who hail from intact families are about 40% less likely to father or bear a child outside of wedlock. That's another very significant factor. The issue of having children outside of wedlock is both a sign of economic disadvantage and, even more importantly, a major cause of the same. Bradford Wilcox goes on in his article published at The Atlantic. A recent study from Harvard and UC Berkeley found that the most important predictor of economic mobility was the low share of single moms in a community. He continues, the idea that marriages have such a strong spillover effect on a community strikes some as a spurious correlation, but there is evidence of a causal relationship, too. In other words, now we're not talking just about correlation, but actually able to document causation. Bradford Wilcox concludes, the intact two-parent family seems to be particularly important for children hailing from less privileged homes and a powerful force for economic mobility when it's the family norm at the community level. Policymakers who feel more comfortable talking about metrics than marriages need to understand that marriage could be one of the most important metrics. That's a very important sentence. Let's hear it again. Policymakers who feel more comfortable talking about metrics than marriages need to understand that marriage could be one of the most important metrics. I'd prefer to put it otherwise. Those who want to bury themselves in the metrics and ignore marriage will see the metrics only go down as marriage goes down as well. In coming days, we'll be taking a closer look at a major report out from the American Academy of Pediatrics, but at this point, it's important to say up front, it is signaling a major alarm for America's parents, but one that we have signaled many times in the past, and that American parents, and Christian parents in particular, should not need to be justified in terms of new research. But the new research has come, and it's very compelling. As Michelle Healy of USA Today reports, in an age when exposure to televisions, smartphones, computers, tablets, and all forms of social media plays a dominant role in the lives of American kids and teens, many families have very few rules in place to manage their children's media use. But for their well-being, that should change, advises the nation's largest group of children's physicians. The American Academy of Pediatrics has revised its policy on social media and children. It now recommends that parents make a media use plan for their families that takes into account not only the quantity, but the quality and location of media used. It should include mealtime and bedtime curfews for media devices and keep all screen media out of kids' bedrooms. Period. Exclamation point. That is an essential recommendation, and it has been coming from many people other than pediatricians before the pediatricians finally decided to make the same recommendation. It should be simple, common sense for American parents and especially for Christian parents. The problem is illustrated by Victor Strasburger, a professor of pediatrics at the University of New Mexico. He's a co-author of the AAP policy statement. He said this, quote, "We are worried that a lot of parents are clueless about their kids' media use and how to manage it appropriately." Furthermore, Strasburger points to this chilling statistic. Teenagers and children are spending more time with media than they are in school. They're spending more time with media than in any other activity other than sleeping. You could make the argument, this pediatrician says, that media have taken over the primary role of teaching kids from schools and parents in many cases. End quote. Let's listen to that again. Here you have a pediatrician saying straightforwardly, not only are many parents clueless, but they have allowed screens to take over the primary teaching role in their children's lives, taking it away from teachers and from the parents themselves. Some other information that should have your attention. The average 8 to 10-year-old spends nearly 8 hours a day with a variety of different media. That's 8 hours a day. Older children and teens now spend more than 11 hours per day with some form of digital media. The presence of a television set in a child's bedroom increases TV viewing even more, as if you needed research to tell you that. And 71% of children and teenagers report having a TV in their bedroom. So add that up. Almost three-quarters of American children and teenagers have a television in the bedroom. Nearly all children and teens are online. That's 84%. 75% of 12 to 17-year-olds have a cell phone, and many of them are smartphones. 88% use text messaging. A final alarm in this report from the American Academy of Pediatrics, not only are many parents apparently clueless, they're apparently willing to remain clueless. Jim Steyer, CEO of Common Sense Media, pointed out that the problem for parents these days is that they have allowed the multiplicity of media outlets in their children's lives to the point that it's very hard for anyone to keep up. As Steyer pointed out to America's parents who should already know this, when you multiply the platforms and the devices, you make your job far more complicated in tracking the media use of your own children and teenagers. It's not easy to monitor things room to room and device to device, he says. But let's point out the obvious. As parents, that's our job. If we allow it to get more complicated, it's our fault. Finally, a recent report from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is ominous and sad. Fight against HIV hits a roadblock. As reporters Ron Winslow and Betsy McKay point out, researchers have hit an unexpected obstacle in their effort to defeat the HIV virus. HIV virus, of course, is the virus that eventually causes AIDS. As they report, a study published last week found that the amount of potentially active HIV that lurks in infected immune system cells could be up to 60 times as large as previously observed. That, as the reporters say, poses a major hurdle for a promising strategy researchers have hoped might one day eradicate the virus and enable HIV patients to go off therapy. The reporters go on to say that AIDS researchers have known for nearly two decades that HIV goes dormant and hides in so-called latent reservoirs in immune system cells where it can't be detected by conventional tests, and it also can't be affected by antiretroviral drugs that attack active virus. But research shows that if therapy is stopped, the virus is reactivated, reigniting the infection. The article in the Wall Street Journal points to the disappointment felt by many researchers who thought they were getting ahead of the HIV virus. Now, in the words of one researcher, it's going to be quite a bit harder than we thought to get rid of all the virus that could rekindle the infection if a patient stops treatment, end quote. Of course, we should all share the disappointment that these researchers have hit this wall. Fighting back against any disease is a good and proper human endeavor. But there's something from a Christian worldview perspective that ought to have our attention as we come to the end of the briefing today. Try as we will, try as we may, we cannot erase the results of human sin. Our bodies, all of us, not just those with the HIV virus, but every single human body, gives testimony to the ravages of sin and the reality of impending death. We can do everything we might do, not only against this virus, but against any other virus or disease, and try to do everything we can to fight against it, and sometimes we can win great victories. But at the end of the day, the symbolism in this article still should haunt us and chasten us with the Christian memory. That try as we will, try as we may, there's a reservoir deep within us that simply cannot be attacked by any form of medicine or any form of therapy or anything short of redemption that comes through Jesus Christ. These researchers found a latent reservoir, to use their language, of infection deep within the human cell. We know there's a latent reservoir of sin deep within every single one of us. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.